You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, November 25th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is our famous day after Thanksgiving show where we have pre-recorded things, but Emma's here. Here, pop Emma up.
Oh, yeah. Hi.
There she is.
Hello.
Where'd
hi.
Go?
Hi.
Here we go, Emma.
Hello.
Where are you? What? Is she there?
I guess what's going
I'm not
on?
Seeing that.
I'm not seeing well, that's fine.
It's not
fine.
Playing on
I'm
the...
I'm here.
Emma's here. Oh, there she is.
Hi.
Emma's here, ladies and gentlemen. Yet, we're not here. We're actually talking in the past or talking to the future as it... Whoa, okay. So much for the music. And we are on break, of course, but we have two new interviews that undoubtedly... almost none of you have heard, and if you did, you forgot about them. And they are interviews that we did on the old Peacock show. Now we did the Majority Report ran on Peacock. It would be rebroadcast, and then sometime I can't remember at what point last year we started doing a second show, which was all interviews. Many of them were really good interviews.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem was that not so many people. Listen to them.
Right.
Peacock's numbers, not great. I never signed it. Did I?
Oh.
Okay. Well, whatever. Anyways, I mean, look, I had no specific information. That was just my sense because...
It just seemed clear.
It seemed clear. Like, you know, you do this long enough and you get people, respond, get feedback on mm-hmm. the show. I know that John from San Antonio watched the show. He would comment on certain things that he want to, you know, feedback on that, which is great. But as far as we could tell, not many other people. So today, as you all are basking in the wake of turkey dinner,
food coma situation,
or hopefully, we have two interviews. The first is one that I did with a reporter at the MIT Technology Review, Karen Howe. She wrote how Facebook got addicted to spreading misinformation. And the thing that was fascinating to me about this interview was just how relentless in the pursuit of growth Facebook was. I imagine they still are. And how sort of like, nefarious they were in trying to hide that information. Like how they got addicted to spreading information, I think is sort of almost in some way a generous, as if it's like there's no agency on the part of Facebook that they're just compelled to do it. As opposed to the fact that Mark Zuckerberg is, you know, pathologically interested in chasing money and growth and, you know, it's not even like they would care about misinformation. The bottom line is what gets clicks, period, end of story. And it may be still relevant with Facebook, but it's also going to be relevant with Twitter. It's going to be relevant with all the social media. In many respects, it's a, you know, like a capitalism story, but just like a spice of technology.
Right. And relevant as ever. Right
and now. Relevant as ever. And then Emma did an interview that recalled for me an interview that I had done a couple of times actually back in the old Majority Report on radio with Chalmers Johnson, who was, I think his book was Blowback actually, now that I think about it, which was about, you know, the implications of our empire. And Emma, tell us about your interview, because apparently what is old is actually also new and present today.
I spoke with David Vine, who is a professor at American University, but also he's written a book called The United States of War, which I'd encourage everybody to check out. But this interview was about something that he had researched for the Quincy Institute about military bases abroad, and how just like the sheer scope of them helped further United States empire, how they are problematic, and getting rid of them slowly but surely is the right way to go. And it was a really just memorable interview, and we did one of these a day, plus the regular show, so it's hard for them to stick out in your mind a year later, but this one certainly did.
So, folks, enjoy these interviews. We will be back. There was a chance I was going to do a live stream, but I don't know. I can't imagine. I'm probably taking a nap.
If might be jonesing, though. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? We'll
for
see.
Some content on exactly. Saturday night.
Exactly.
Now you know how to do the whole stream.
I know to do the stream. OBS. I could pop on and do that, you know, at different times. But in the meantime, folks, enjoy these two interviews. We are going to... Oh, I didn't do the ads. We got a couple ads here. Just a reminder. Today is the final day. 11:59 p.m. Eastern. For 30% off with the coupon code Friday at sunsetlakesebade.com. Sunset Lake Sebade is basically cranking it up to help America's most consumerist holiday and turning it into a fundraising opportunity for a great organization. Here's how it works. Visit sunsetlakesebade.com starting November 21st. All Sebade products will be 30% off with coupon code Friday. That's not all. All overs over $100 are going to receive a jar of Sebade gummy bears, a $40 value for free. Sunset Lake Sebade will donate 10% of proceeds from this Black Friday sale to Feeding Chittenden. It's the largest emergency food provider in Vermont, feeding over 12,000 people a year, each year. Sunset Lake is an amazing company. They really are. They have, they really walk the walk. On top of all their great business practices, you know, $20 minimum wage, the mostly employee-owned business, and donating thousands of dollars to stuff like union strike funds, nature conservation, food shelves, refugee resettlement organizations. We did a fundraiser with them on Election Day. We ended up, between the two of us, sending $5,000 to Planned Parenthood. But they've done thousands of dollars to give directly and... I mean, I think about $30,000 just in their short time they've been a company. So check them out. But their products are also amazing. I can assure you that the way I got through Thanksgiving yesterday between the kids, and with all due respect, my father, was leaning heavily on the tinctures. Probably the gummy bears with a little Sebade, and maybe even the one with a little THC. But you can also get coffee with Sebade, get fudge with Sebade, on and on. It's just a great company. All of their products get third-party tested, and you can see what's in it on their website, and they'll send it to you and when you buy the products. Again, visit sunsetlakesebade.com. Use the coupon code Friday to take advantage of these deals. Sale ends November 27th. Some restrictions may apply. And our second sponsor for the day, I got to tell you, is also a product that I've used now for I don't know how many years, 4 or 5 years. I got very, very, when you get a little bit older, you go and see the dentist, and one day they go like, ooh, you got some issues, big time. Mm-hmm. And you're getting old, and like, I don't want fake teeth. And at the very least, I don't want it, you know, my 50s or 60s or 70s for that matter. We'll see. But you got to develop good dental hygiene habits. End of story. That means brushing. That means flossing. And really, it doesn't hurt to also use a mouthwash too, frankly. But how do you do that? For me, Quip changed my ability to maintain a habit. They make it easy for you to not only brush your teeth with a great vibrating electric toothbrush that you don't need to plug in, you don't forget at home when you travel and whatnot, but then they also came up with this amazing flosser system. They've got a couple actually different things. They've got two different types of flossers. The design is amazing. I've always said like they're a design company that builds really good dental hygiene habits.
Because you just want to use the product.
What's that?
And you just want to use the product.
And now, listen to this. They have a rechargeable cordless water flosser, which my dentist just the other day said, time for one of these. Quip hits all the right spots with gentle or deep clean pressure at the touch of a button. It's easy to control, and it's even easier to refill, so your countertops stay just as clean as your teeth. You can really get in there. It doesn't matter. Plaque, popcorn, leftover spinach, doesn't matter. Gone with precision thanks to the 360-degree rotating magnetic floss tip that snaps into place. The whole Quip lineup will have your mouth in tip-top shape. It's left over 9 million mouths happy and healthy. Check it out. Trust me. Take the plunge into feel-good flossing. Go to quip.com/majority right now for your first refill on floss tips, brush heads, and more for free. Spelled G-E-T-Q-U-I-P. GetQuip.com/majority. Plus, shop Quip's lowest prices of the year this holiday season. Quip, it's the good habits company. Check it out. GetQuip.com/majority. Okay, now for Karen Howe from the MIT Technology Review on Facebook and its addiction to misinformation. And then Emma will have an interview with David Vine, professor of political anthropology at American University, on the enormous sort of like empire that we maintain in the form of U.S. bases. And we will see you on Monday. Have a great weekend and happy Thanksgiving. So joining me now is Karen Howe. She is the senior artificial intelligence reporter at the MIT Technology Review. And this is a story as we increasingly look at our social media and the major platforms for both their concentration and the ill that they can cause society when it comes to disinformation. We are desperately trying to sort of catch up to this technology and what it means and how it's going wrong. And Karen, your entree, I guess, into finding out what has really gone sideways, and really it's almost like a runaway train on some level, although there does feel like there may be somebody pushing it a little bit, was interesting in and of itself. Welcome to the program, and tell us, how did you end up getting sort of into this story in a way that is, I think, different from the way that most reporters end up reporting on a story?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Sam. So as you said, my mouthful title, I am the senior AI reporter, and I cover artificial intelligence, and specifically cover artificial intelligence and its impact on society. So I've always, since starting this beat, been very interested in the people that are creating AI and the companies that are creating AI and how their algorithms are changing everything from the way we eat, live, work, believe. And at the time, about a year ago, I was covering this big lab, AI lab, and I'd done a profile of them to just talk a little bit about how they had sort of influenced the way that AI is being developed and it's impacting us. And Facebook has a huge AI lab as well. So I actually got a email from the Facebook communications team saying, like, we really loved your profile of this other AI lab. If you ever would like to do a deep dive into our AI lab, we would be happy to talk about that. And for me at the time, I was like, Facebook has a huge AI lab, and I want to know what are they doing? Because there are so many conversations that are happening about the impact that Facebook's algorithms have on our society, but we don't really understand like how the sausage is made. And I kind of wanted to dig into that a bit more and understand what was happening on the ground. And so that was my starting point. And that was me they contacted me in April of last year. So that was me almost a year ago.
Wow.
Those conversations.
What do you think was, I mean, what were they, I can't imagine that what they were hoping you would write ended up being what you wrote. I would be very impressed if that's what they thought. What do you think that they thought that you would, what did they think that you would write?
So what I learned very quickly is they had offered for me to speak to their, taking a step back. What I learned very quickly is there are three AI teams at Facebook. Which is a lot of AI teams, but they had offered me to speak with the fundamental AI research team. And that has absolutely nothing to do with the product. And they also have an applied AI research team, which takes what the fundamental AI research team does. And when it serendipitously happens to have some kind of applicability to Facebook, they have this like technology transfer process that they call where they pull it out of the fundamental AI lab and polish it a little bit and then put it into, their portal camera or like the photo tagging algorithm that allows you to automatically recognize friends and photos, whatever. And then their third team is the responsible AI team. And they had offered me to specifically look at the fundamental AI research team.
I'm sorry. The third team is the response AI team?
The responsible AI team, which is the one that I ultimately covered.
Ah, okay. And what does responsible AI team mean?
It's supposed to deal with this problem that I talked about, like what is the impact of our algorithms on society? How do we mitigate harmful impacts, maximize the positive impacts, and take responsibility for our AI?
So it's almost like you have a pure science lab, an applied science lab, and then the third one is the implications of the applied science lab.
Exactly.
And they wanted you to look at the pure science lab.
They wanted me to look at the pure science lab.
And that did not happen. So you ended up looking at the responsible AI.
And I started looking at the responsible AI team.
And who was the director of that?
Joaquin Quinonero Condola. And he actually used to be the director of the applied AI team. And then he became the director of, well, his formal title is not director, but then he started leading this responsible AI team. And when I learned that there were these three labs, what Facebook Communications did was they set me up with a series of interviews of leadership within the fundamental AI research lab. But through the course of these interviews, they also set me up with Joaquin. And when I went to look at his LinkedIn profile, he was probably like the sixth leadership interview that I had. I was looking and I was like, wait a minute. He was the director of the applied AI lab. And then he became the director of this responsible AI AI team. And it was just very curious to me because first of all, I didn't know that Facebook had a responsible AI team. And second of all, I was like, it's unique because a lot of times companies will start a responsible AI team because it's like the hot thing to do, but they'll hire someone externally and then that person will fail because they don't necessarily have the relationships. They don't necessarily have the cachet at the company to really carry this work through. But he was clearly a central leader at the company that was then asked to take this on. So I thought, oh, maybe he could actually succeed. So that's when I asked the communications team, I no longer want to cover the fundamental AI lab. Let me talk to this guy.
And how comfortable were they with that?
They were very excited because the responsible AI team had not gotten a lot of coverage. Even though it had basically started right after Cambridge Analytica. So it had been around for 3 years. And at the time it wasn't called the Responsible AI Team. That was a name that they adopted, in 2020, but they were like, we've been doing this work for 3 years. We are ready to present it to the world. And, that's my expertise as a reporter. Like I cover AI, but I specifically cover how AI impacts society. So they thought, this is a good fit. Like, this is what you care about. This is your area. We are ready to kind of show the world what we've done. And so that's how it started.
And so the people understand because, I think when people understand what the responsible AI team is, and just the name itself gives you a little bit of clue as to why this entity is created and why they would be excited that you're covering it. It is akin in some respects to a company that has a scandal about, let's say, diversity, and they hire a diversity expert to come in and start a program. We're going to do a sensitivity program. And before we get to sort of what you discovered about how this responsible AI team operates, because this is really the essence of your story that is so fascinating and I think illuminating. What was it that created, what was the scandal, I guess, and what was the public context for the creation of this responsible AI team?
The scandal was Cambridge Analytica. Facebook was undergoing the biggest PR crisis they'd ever faced. They were losing the trust of its users and its employees. And they created a number of responsible X teams. It wasn't just responsible AI.
But for those people who may not be, you know, well-read into this, just remind people what the whole Cambridge Analytica scandal was.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not that you can, encapsulate it in a few minutes.
It was the largest privacy breach that Facebook ever faced, where this firm, what do we call it, Cambridge Analytica, political analytical firm?
They're a political data firm, analysis firm, targeting firm, I guess.
They had acquired a lot of data of Facebook users without the user's consent to then help various campaigns, including the presidential Trump campaign, to figure out exactly how to target ads to different users so that those users, it would sway their vote. And around the same time, then the Russian interference story started happening, and there was this concern that bad Russian actors were using Facebook's targeting algorithms as well to precisely target users with misinformation to confuse them and disrupt the election process. So this whole conversation that sort of surrounded the creation of the responsible AI team was very much about our algorithms, our targeting algorithms have been co-opted and abused in these ways that have sort of are completely unintentional, and we need to get ahead of it. We need to start actually more sincerely thinking about how to actually design these algorithmic systems so that they can't be abused in such detrimental ways.
And so that is the task of, and from your perspective, the Candela, he approached this with a certain amount of sincerity. Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, Joaquin, every time I talked to him, I very much got the sense that he genuinely cares a lot about this work. He joined Facebook because of, for various reasons, but he joined it during the Arab Spring, and he is Spanish born, but he actually was raised in Morocco, where he saw a lot of the oppressive government regimes that the Arab Spring as a revolution was then trying to resist. So it was actually, there was a very personal motivation for him to join Facebook. At the time he was like, oh, the potential of social media is so great. It can affect so much positive social change. I really want to be part of that. And then when Cambridge Analytica happened, he was blindsided. He was like, what does it mean for my integrity as a person to continue working at this company? But because of this promise of what social media could be, he stuck with it. And because of this opportunity to lead the responsible AI team, he stuck with it. So he went on this journey himself, where he had just been a technologist who hadn't really been thinking about these problems. And he started reading very broadly about how does technology affect society in ways that aren't always intended? How do we design not just algorithms, but products? How do we conduct engineering in a way that gets rid of these unintended harms? So he was very sincere about it, but the issue is the context in which he's operating.
You know what? Let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about that context. Well, because that is ultimately really the nub of the story, is that on some level, they are, I think this, the responsible AI is chasing something, but it turns out to be in some respects the wrong thing. And it really is a question as to how that happens when you have someone who is sincere about chasing the right thing. I think we'll make more sense out of that when we return. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Karen Howe in just a moment. I've been talking to Karen Howe about her reporting on what started as a report on one of three artificial intelligence labs embedded in Facebook. They wanted you to come in and do a profile of their pure AI lab where AI is just developed. There are two others. One is the applied AI lab at Facebook, which basically cherry picks stuff from the pure lab and applies it to their social media platform. And about 3 years ago, they developed a third AI lab, the responsible AI lab, that looked at the implications of the deployment of this AI technology and how it was impacting things, and ostensibly how we can change the deployment of that AI or change the structure of that AI so that we don't get these unintended consequences like people coming in like Cambridge Analytica, for instance, and abusing this technology to create unintended change. So Karen, what strikes me is that you have, in some respects, your piece is also a profile of Joaquin Candela, who is the head of this responsible AI lab. And you say that his background led him to really see the power of social media in the context of the Arab Spring. So he knew that was his perception of this technology that it can provide people a mechanism in which to communicate to create social change. He came to understand, was sort of blindsided by the idea that it can work the opposite way, that the technology uses the people to create social change as opposed to the people using the technology to create social change.
That's a really great way of putting it. Yeah.
And so so let's talk about what his mission was and then why it turned out to be the wrong mission.
So some context into my reporting process. What's interesting about covering Facebook is you only get access to people that are very heavily media trained, and there is a very tough company line, so to speak, in terms of what they can and cannot say. So it was actually quite hard for me to get Joaquin to tell me what his original vision was for this team, because he could only talk to me about what the current work was. but there are kind of some signals for what helped me sort of hone what I think the original vision was. The first thing is I spoke with the CTO as well, and I was like, how would you describe the responsible AI team? Chief Technology Officer. And I was like, you know, I've been talking with Joaquin about the current work that he's doing. Is this the only work that the responsible AI team will take on? And the chief technology officer says, well, we call it the responsible AI team, not the AI bias team, which is what they were working on, because we want it to be to have a broad mandate and to think about all of the implications of algorithms and how it impacts society and mitigate the harms of unintended consequences. So that's one signal. And then I also spoke with a really close, longtime friend of Joaquin's, Zubin Garamani, who now works at Google. And he said, Joaquin, like many people working in tech in the past couple of years, has realized the power and potential of the technologies that they're building to have good, be a force for good and a force for bad. And I know that he's thinking about all of these things. He's thinking about how Facebook's algorithms, you know, change people's beliefs, how it changes how people interact. He's thinking about all of these things. That's why he took on this role. So I believe that his original vision for this team was to have this very big picture lens of let's think about all of the implications and try and overhaul the way that we design AI or the AI that we are designing to have more positive effects.
But the CTO gave you the clue that his mandate currently has been narrowed, although there's a potential to go wider, to AI bias.
AI bias.
And so explain to us what that means. And because it sounds like, oh, yeah, no, you shouldn't have bias. But it is reacting to, it is, tell us what it's what it means and what it's reacting to. Because what it's reacting to is a political concern and a public relations concern that has to do with capacity for growth, ultimately.
So maybe I'll start a little one step back, which is responsible AI, as we've already talked about, it's really about mitigating the harms the algorithms can have. And AI bias is one specific harm that you can have. The algorithms can sometimes have discriminatory impacts on people, as we've already seen through many, many headlines over the past couple of years. You know, facial recognition is racist, and like when Face ID first came out on the iPhone, like it was having trouble recognizing Black people, or it was unlocking the phone when it was a different Asian person. You know, like all of those things, that is AI bias and discrimination, and it is legitimately a harm that needs to be worked on. But there are so many, if you rank the harms that Facebook's algorithms have perpetuated in the last few years that we are now aware of and that the company was aware of even before the public was aware of, discrimination's probably not number one on that list. But the reason why they started focusing on that is there's a number of reasons. I mean, one was that the larger AI community, all of these researchers that are working on this stuff and they meet at these conferences and they discuss these ideas, discrimination was one of the first harms that they realized that they were having. So a lot of the responsible AI work was sort of equated with AI bias, even though AI bias is a very narrow definition of responsible AI. But the other thing that happened is Trump got elected, and around the campaign that Trump was having and when Trump came into power, there was this narrative that Republican policymakers started saying that tech giants have anti-conservative bias. And this was particularly troubling for Facebook because Facebook has always been very worried about being regulated in a way that restricts its growth. And when Trump actually successfully got to the presidential seat, Joel Kaplan, who's the vice president of global policy at Facebook and is the highest ranking Republican, told Mark Zuckerberg, you need to be very careful in this political environment, because even if we don't have anti-conservative bias, we've already lost the trust of conservatives. And if we do anything to continue exacerbating that, we are going to be in dangerous waters with a Republican-led government. And so in the 2018 ramp up to the 2018 midterm elections in the US, this whole like anti-conservative bias of tech platforms became like a really, it got louder and louder. Trump tweeted out hashtag stop the bias. That was like all over the internet. And it was like a week after that happened that Mark Zuckerberg called his first meeting with Joaquin after the creation of this lab, this new lab, and said, you now need to teach me everything you know about AI bias and how do we get it out of our content moderation algorithms. And so, I mean, it could be a coincidence that those things happened a week apart from one another. But my sense from talking with many sources about just the culture that Facebook has and how everything is oriented around growth is that they started focusing very heavily on this whole AI bias thing, in large part because of this political
fear that it was going to create a political force that was going to inhibit their growth. I mean, there's a burgeoning antitrust perspective that is arguably transpartisan, both Republicans. It could have been more. I mean, certainly we hear them demonize Facebook, not necessarily for the same reasons that we might hear on the left in terms of that, but it could end up in regulating their growth in some fashion. We should also say Joel Kaplan, former George Bush advisor, George W. Bush. I mean, this guy is, you know, a right winger, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he was in any way incorrect, that it might lead to some regulatory action just out of spite from Donald Trump. So, yeah. But the problem here is that we are now far afield from the implications of spreading misinformation and disinformation that, for instance, if you were to have, let's say, a pandemic and you needed people to wear masks or you needed people to believe that it was real, or as a society, or you needed people to, vaccinate based upon the that problem is being completely unaddressed. And it is, from your perspective, I think you've already stated like the bias issue is sort of not you would not rank the bias issue very high on the unintended consequences and their implications to society relative to this issue of misinformation and disinformation.
Exactly.
So what are they doing about that?
So,
and why aren't they doing anything?
I mean, we'll never know truly what, if I could get in Mark Zuckerberg's brain. There's a little bit of nuance here. It's not that Facebook didn't do anything with misinformation. They created this team called the Integrity Team, which focuses on catching misinformation. So this is their team that whenever Mark comes out and says, we're going to build better AI for content moderation, that's the Integrity Team. The Integrity Team they're also the ones that Facebook has like quarterly reports that they come out with, say, called the Community Enforcement Report, where they'll report numbers of like, this is how much hate speech we've taken down, this is how much nudity we've taken down, et cetera, et cetera. That's the Integrity Team. They focused specifically on catching misinformation, but what my piece really tries to say and what I found with my reporting is that's not actually enough to solve these problems, because the way that AI works, in order to catch the misinformation, you need a lot of it first to train the AI to learn what to look at. If you want to remove Holocaust denial from your platform, you need to wait for a certain number of Holocaust denial comments before you can teach the AI to recognize with precision, and it still will get it wrong sometimes, what Holocaust denial is. And then if, you know, we're talking about a different genocide denial, you can't just apply the Holocaust denial AI to that. You have to train another AI to do that. And so in addition to catching misinformation, you also need this other piece where you need to fundamentally overhaul your systems to stop promoting it in the first place.
So the idea is that misinformation is not a static quantity and exactly. Or quality. And so you cannot, you don't have time to train. You need to sort of pre-train. So what kind of things would prevent, how would you basically nip it in the bud, I guess is really what it comes down to.
I mean, I don't have answers to this, but I mean.
But isn't the issue that you can't nip it in the bud and also serve the master of growth? If you are Mark Zuckerberg and you want every single person to adopt Facebook on the planet, and then who knows beyond that, you can't serve that master, as it were, and also the master of we need to inhibit the dangerous aspects of what we've created here.
Exactly. Facebook has known and even publicly admitted that violating content gets the most engagement, and they have this like Mark Zuckerberg published this chart where, you know, it shows on the y-axis how much engagement something gets, and on the x-axis like how close it is to their policy line where it becomes not allowed on the platform. And it's this swoop where it gets more and more engagement as you get closer and closer to the policy line. And he admits that. At the same time, he's telling all of his teams, you have to maximize engagement. And all of the AI algorithms that recommend us content recommend the order in which we see posts, which groups we're told to join, which pages we might like. All of that is deployed with an eye towards maximizing engagement. So it's just fundamentally, these are incompatible objectives to try and reduce violating content while also maximizing engagement. And in that same post where Mark showed this swoop, like he basically said, oh, but then we're just going to create these AI models to catch it. And so we're going to change the reflection of this line so that the closer it gets to the policy line, the less engagement's going to have. But you can't just do that through catching things retroactively, because you in the time that it takes you to actually train up this new AI to catch the newest form of misinformation, that misinformation's already gone viral.
Right. I mean, it's like almost like, well, we're going to stop. We're not going to stop the shootings, but we're going to recover the bullets. Well, they've already done the damage at that point.
Exactly.
What's also strikes me about this and is that this is all in an attempt. I mean, it's, but you have these sort of these two agendas that are inconsistent with each other and that are at loggerheads, and they know that, and they haven't been able to figure out, and they sort of pretend that they can, that we can actually make it just drop off a cliff right when it gets right up against the line of our stated public policies about what we're doing to prevent this type of damaging misinformation out there. They haven't figured it out. They probably won't figure it out. The only way you could do that would be as if you had human beings, but that would be far, far too expensive and ruin the entire business model, wouldn't it?
I mean, they do have human beings, right?
But you need a lot.
They have thousands. And there's been significant reporting about these human content moderators suffering PTSD from the amount of violent, hateful, awful content that they have to see every day. So, yeah, that in and of itself is also a harm. If they were to decide that they want to deploy more content moderators than they have now to just be filtering all this stuff before the AI has learned to filter it. So, I mean, there's a multi-pronged approach that I think Facebook needs to take. First of all, they need to chuck this growth, engagement, maximization objective that they have and have had for so long. They need to not just catch misinformation, but they also need to think about and change the way that they propagate it. And they need to figure out some way that they can do this without just pushing all of the burden onto these content human content moderators that then have to engage in this awful, awful content that leads them to post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'm not saying that it's an easy problem, but I'm just saying that they haven't even taken the first step. If they're not even admitting to the public that their algorithms are amplifying misinformation and they're not having a centralized coordinated effort to figure out exactly what that amplification, how the amplification is happening, how they can tamp down that amplification, then all of the things that they say to us, all the things that Mark Zuckerberg says publicly about, oh, we just haven't made progress on this because it's so technically challenging, is totally, totally misleading.
Well, it is a fascinating story, an important one, and I would suggest there's a third option, too. We cannot rely on them to jettison their desire for growth. We can cap it, and we can shrink it as a society, because their primary agenda, their primary mission is not consistent with a healthy society, and we have the right as a society to make that choice. Karen Howe, thank you so much for your time today. It's a fascinating piece, How Facebook Got Addicted to Spreading Misinformation. Folks can find that at the MIT Technology Review.
Thank you
so much.
In the wake of the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was commendable, and then at the dawn of their pivot to China, which is concerning, there is a shift happening right before our very eyes in the United States' foreign policy. But it's not one of systemic demilitarization. It's merely a new focus. And the limitations of that approach, I think, should concern some people, because the sheer breadth of the United States' military presence around the globe will shock you. Here to talk about this is David Vine, professor of anthropology at American University and author of The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State, who wrote an excellent brief for the Quincy Institute alongside Patterson Deppin and Leah Bolger entitled Drawdown, Improving U.S. and Global Security Through Military-Based Closures Abroad. Welcome to the show, David. Really appreciate you being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Emma. It's great to talk to you.
Of course. So 750 military bases in 80 countries. Your brief talks about that. And I don't think people understand how abnormal that is and how insane and bloated and expensive, and also I think how much that incentivizes military conflict to continue because there are all these branches. So I guess let's just start there. Talk about the sheer number of military bases throughout the globe.
This is little known in the United States. It's really the face of the United States in many ways overseas, that the United States possesses 750 military bases outside the 50 states in Washington, D.C., that is in other people's lands, in 80 countries and colonies, as you put it. I think it actually helps to picture some of these bases. They range in size from small, what are often referred to as lily pad bases, to bases that are the size of small or really not so small U.S. American towns called Little Americas frequently, or America towns. And these are tens of thousands of U.S. troops, tens of thousands of family members, schools, hospitals. And I think we should think about the infrastructure in our own communities here in the United States, infrastructure that's so often crumbling, roads, bridges, schools. And then try to picture in your mind, if you haven't seen one of these bases abroad in Germany or Italy or Japan or South Korea or Honduras or on and on, try to picture huge city-sized base that we're investing $55 billion in a year. And that's just to maintain these bases, to keep them running on an annual basis without the costs of the personnel that staff them and work on them and that serve on them. That brings the total that we're spending to maintain bases abroad to well over $100 billion, billion with a B, a year. Compare this to all the other militaries on Earth. The United States probably has more than three times the number of foreign military bases compared to all the other militaries on Earth. The United Kingdom has a large number, but probably around 145 by the latest report. Russia and France have far fewer, maybe three dozen among them. And then a few other countries have a handful. China, for example, has five foreign military bases, five compared to 750 U.S. bases abroad. One other comparison that just puts this in perspective, and I think drives home where the focus of our foreign policy has been for far too long. There are 276 U.S. embassies, consulates, and missions around the world. Compare that to nearly three times as many U.S. bases abroad. The focus of our foreign policy has been on war making, on building bases, on maintaining huge numbers of bases and troops around the world, really since World War II, and that's what has to change.
So I want to return to that five figure for China when we return to talking about the new Biden administration posture towards China. But I want to expand or ask you to expand on the World War II historical point, because that marks a massive shift in the United States on the global stage, right? We were the dominant world power, and I say were in the past tense because I believe we are currently witnessing an empire in decline for a lot of the reasons we'll lay out today. But that was the shining moment for the United States and an opportunity for them to expand their global reach. And that seemed like the moment in which these military bases multiplied to the degree that we're seeing now.
No, that's absolutely right. The United States has had foreign military bases on other people's land since shortly after independence, initially on Native American people's lands that enabled the conquest of territory across North America and the expansion of the United States. But on a global scale, it's really during World War II that the US military builds a collection of foreign military bases that had never been seen in human history. A larger collection of foreign military bases truly around the globe, more than any people, country, or empire in world history. And after World War II, a goodly number of these bases closed, but the United States military maintained a permanent infrastructure of bases on other people's lands. And this persisted throughout the Cold War, going up and down during the wars in Korea and Vietnam. But when the Cold War ends, you might think, oh, well, these bases that were such a component of the strategy of the United States facing off against the Soviet Union in the Cold War, you'd think that the bases could have closed. And many did, about 60%. But again, upwards of 800 bases at that time, sometimes numbering more than 1,000 after the end of the Cold War, remained in place. The basic infrastructure of bases remained in place. And actually, since the end of the Cold War, the breadth of US bases abroad has actually doubled. At the end of the Cold War, there were about 40 countries hosting US bases abroad. Now there are about 80 countries and colonies hosting US bases abroad. So while the total number has shrunk from about 1,600 to now 750, currently by our best estimate, the breadth of these bases, the spread, the geographic spread of these bases has grown dramatically.
Did that happen during the Gulf War? Was that a part of the new neocon project under Bush in particular, Bush 1?
It's happened in a few phases. The first, with the George W. Bush administration, indeed, expanded the breadth of U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf in particular, in the greater Middle East, to support the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, to support parts of the war on terror throughout the globe, though we see a major growth of U.S. bases, smaller mostly, but not entirely, in Africa, in parts of East Asia, Central and Eastern Europe, including in the Obama and Trump administrations. So it's really been a bipartisan policy, again, since World War II, but in the post-Cold War era, it's continued to be a bipartisan policy. Again, well, as our report shows and argues, to the really damage of the United States, these bases that so often are portrayed for far too long have been portrayed as necessary to protect U.S. and global security in a whole variety of ways are undermining U.S. and global security in ways that we outline in our report.
So I'm going to ask if you could expand on some of those ways. The environmental impacts were something that I had never considered before that you touch on, but there are other ways in which these bases and the sheer number of them do harm the United States. And I try to frame foreign policy conversations in a way that affects the globe, but the only way you get to talk to United States politicians is to frame it in the way, how is it going to hurt us? So let's talk about how it would hurt the United States, or how it does hurt the United States to have this kind of bloated presence.
Let's talk first about the money, the $55 billion a year. Again, just to maintain the bases themselves, not the troops, just the bases. That's a budget that's larger than the size of the State Department's budget itself. And again, shows the distorted priorities we have when it comes to engaging with the world and pursuing a foreign policy. So we start there. We have to think, too, about the ways in which these bases cause what is frequently referred to as blowback. The presence of bases has been a fantastic recruiting tool for militants like Al-Qaeda. Guantanamo Bay is the most prominent case in point. But even before the attacks of 9/11, Osama bin Laden for years was railing against the presence of U.S. bases and troops in the Muslim Holy Land in Saudi Arabia. This became a rallying cry for Al-Qaeda and similar militant groups in the post 9/11 era as well. So bases have a tendency to actually cause more harm in a whole variety of ways. Bases are also found in at least 38 non-democratic countries. So these are countries that are led by non-democratic regimes, frequently repressive, murderous regimes, including most of the countries in the Persian Gulf region, where U.S. bases are actually supporting undemocratic governments and regimes and blocking the spread of democracy, contrary to some longstanding claims that U.S. bases are spreading democracy. There are a whole variety of other ways that bases harm local people, including the environmental harm that bases cause. Basically, bases, wherever they're located, are not good for the environment. And if you think about what military bases are, it's easy to understand. They store large stockpiles of dangerous weaponry, hazardous materials, chemicals. And just by the very storage of them, their damage can occur, but there are also a long track record of both accidents and sometimes intentional dumping of hazardous materials and other environmentally damaging materials. So this is a well-documented track record around the world. Again, not winning us very many friends. Accidents, other kinds of accidents, as well as crimes committed by U.S. military personnel on bases abroad have also spurred protest. Coupled with, you know, you can probably, I think it helps for people in the United States to imagine how would we feel if a foreign military had a base in our town or city, wherever we might live in the United States.
Right.
How would it feel to live next to even a British or a French base, let alone a Russian or Chinese base? Would we want, you know, high-powered weaponry stored by a foreign military near where our homes? Foreign military bases, wherever they're located, tend to irritate local populations and cause protest, damaging the reputation of the United States in the process. And right. That's just the beginning.
Well, I mean, the only thing I think Americans could think of as analogous potentially is the current way that heavily militarized police forces occupy largely black neighborhoods. And the obvious and understandable resentment that at least thoughtful Americans can point to and see why this has caused such animus and such resentment, you can extrapolate that and think about a military base that occupies a country that heightens tensions and does not make a home feel like a home in many ways because of their presence. So that's, I think, a useful way for some people to look at it potentially. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more specifically about the Biden administration, their foreign policy, and how it relates to your attempt and our attempt here to refocus the way that Americans view our foreign policy. We'll be right back. So one of the things I found really fascinating in your brief with the Quincy Institute was the emphasis on how the number of military bases encourages wider conflict because of just their sheer presence. If we're weighing a diplomatic response, oh, well, we already have a military base in X place in this country. And it just, it makes the convenience of conflict more convenient. It's even more convenient. And that's why I found the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan to be so monumental and important. Because every incentive structure in the United States, and also, by the way, in the way that the press covers military conflict, because their sources are in the intelligence community who will feed information that favors conflict because they are invested in such, there are a variety of apparatuses that encourage conflict. And the Biden administration, to their credit, really bucked those. So I guess we can talk about the good in how they responded and how they chose to say, I'm not going to cave to the pressure of these institutions. But then we'll talk about their shift towards China, which I find scary.
I do as well. But, you know, you pointed to a number of the other ways in which U.S. bases abroad undermine U.S. national security and global security that I didn't get a chance to touch on. Most importantly, the way in which these bases abroad have served as a launch pad for wars. The catastrophic last 20 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq and 23 other countries. Most people don't know that U.S. combat troops have been in a total of 25 countries, far beyond Afghanistan and Iraq alone.
People have no concept of how involved we are in Africa, for example, which is something we also should be paying attention to, but continue.
Indeed, beginning with Somalia and Libya and the disastrous wars waged there, the presence of this huge infrastructure of U.S. bases abroad made it all too easy for policymakers to choose war as a policy option. And the result has been 20 years of disastrous war that have cost U.S. taxpayers, just the wars alone, $8 trillion, and that's trillion with a T, taken the lives of 4.5 million people, 4.5 million people, 38 million people displaced in the eight most violent wars the United States has been involved in. The infrastructure of bases has made this possible. It actually, as my book, The United States of War, shows, has actually made it more likely that policymakers would choose war. I think you also pointed to another danger of this huge infrastructure of bases, which is that while frequently proponents say that these bases are necessary because they deter enemies, they actually tend to only encourage anyone who might be portrayed as an enemy, for example, China or Russia, to respond in kind, to build up their own military forces, and in some cases, foreign military bases. Although, again, no other country on earth has even close to the number of foreign military bases the United States does. But again, I think it helps to think, how would U.S. leaders, how would U.S. citizens respond if China or Russia were to build even a single military base near the borders of the United States? Now, mind you, again, they don't have a single military base near the borders of the United States, while the United States encircles both China and Russia with hundreds, literally hundreds of foreign military bases. And one of the troubling things about this recent deal alliance with Australia and the UK is that it, and few people have been paying attention to this, it is creating a new military buildup of US bases and troops in Australia, further encircling China. Again, if the shoe were on the other foot, if China or Russia were to build even a single base near U.S. borders, I think you'd see U.S. politicians and ordinary citizens calling for a military response. And that's what military bases tend to do. They tend to escalate military tensions and cause an upward cycle of militarization and frequently arms races along with them. Again, tremendously dangerous because of the potential for setting off not just a Cold War, but potentially a hot one. Now, you pointed to Afghanistan and the importance of withdrawing U.S. forces and U.S. bases from Afghanistan, which I too supported. But it really was insufficient because of the huge infrastructure just in the region alone. Similarly, with the announcement of this really terribly named AUKUS deal,
or Triple Alliance. So again, the UK and the Australia and then US at the end.
Yeah, this what I'm referring to is the Triple Alliance, which really reflects not just Cold War era thinking, but a kind of 19th century thinking. It's really going in the opposite direction of the positive signs we saw from the Biden administration in withdrawing from Afghanistan. What it's calling for is not just the submarine deal that most of the media attention has focused on, a deal to sell Australia nuclear-powered submarines, which is, we should pay attention to it because it's quite dangerous in its impacts on nuclear non-proliferation, namely that the United States almost certainly, or perhaps the UK, will be transferring weapons grade, nuclear weapons grade, highly enriched uranium to Australia as part of the deal to build submarines, nuclear powered submarines for Australia, which could end up fueling nuclear proliferation, not just for Australia, but for other parts of the world as well. But again, what people haven't been paying attention to is that the nuclear powered submarines are only a small part of a much larger military buildup that the United States and Australia have agreed to, where the United States will be building up its U.S. base presence in Australia, as well as its forces, air forces, naval forces, land forces, while also agreeing to deals on weapons development, including hypersonic weapons and electromagnetic weapons, spying, space activities, cyber activities, and even a mining deal. So this is a much larger buildup that, most dangerously of all, is really as close as we've come to a formal declaration of a new Cold War against China as we've come to this stage. I mean, I think many people would agree that we're in a Cold War already. This is a near formal declaration of that Cold War, and that alone is tremendously disturbing and dangerous.
I have so many responses, and I wish we had more time. I could talk to you about this for forever. One, I think we don't even need to guess what the United States would do in response to a military base being at our border. Just look at our posture towards Cuba because of a perceived ideological alliance with, with the communist ideology that could provide a threat to us because it's so close to our border. And I mean, we can just see it there. And then in regards to China and this deal, and I appreciate you explaining how it's a lot bigger than the media has, I think, or the top line headlines of the deal have been articulated, is the fact that this is basically a direct declaration of, okay, this conflict is not just going to be about two competing economic systems, even though we exist in global capitalism and these corporations are multinational and this seems silly, but that is what we're going to do. It's going to be a military one. And you mentioned at the start of our interview these five military bases that China has. This is going to encourage China to ramp up its militarism. And it shows the limitations of Biden's worldview, in my opinion, because if one was truly trying to end the endless wars, which is what he said at the United Nations, he would do what you're advocating, closing military bases, but they still want to have their cake and eat it too, the United States. We want to be the big bully on the national stage, but not as big of a bully as Trump or as Bush. We want to still have the option to have our hands all over the globe. But, you know, not necessarily do a systemic overhaul, which is exactly what's necessary, not just for world peace. I'm not just a hippy dippy, which I certainly am, but for the preservation of the United States, because this is untenable. This is not able to continue in the way that we need to, especially when we're going over retreads of Cold War foreign policy with Russia. And let's just like tack them on to China as a way to have a new enemy that everyone can get rich off of, including defense contractors and including industry, when rivalry breeds capital.
I couldn't agree more, although I think it's not one key amendment I would make is that everyone won't get rich. The weapons manufacturers, as you said, they'll get rich. The beneficiaries of the military-industrial complex, or what Eisenhower initially termed the military-industrial congressional complex, they're going to laugh their way all the way to the bank, just as they have on $8 trillion that have been spent on war since 2001. The buildup of U.S. forces in Australia and a near formal declaration of a Cold War against China is going to be fantastic for the weapons manufacturers, for the military-industrial congressional complex, if we don't stop it, which we must stop it, because as you said, this is untenable. The endless wars will continue. And that's my greatest fear in the wake of Biden appropriately and long overdue withdrawing from Afghanistan, that the United States is going to end up in yet another war. We are still engaged in some endless wars in Iraq and Syria and Yemen in some ways, among others. But the United States will end up in yet more wars, and most catastrophically of all, could end up in not just a cold war with China, but a hot war that could potentially be a nuclear war that should be really unthinkable to all of us. The two most powerful nations on Earth going to war, both nuclear armed powers, the catastrophe of the last 20 years could look small in comparison.
And I know
that we have to stop.
Yeah, and I know for some people that may sound hyperbolic, but it's not. We're not saying that Biden is going to start the war, right? I don't think that that's realistic. But when you create this framework for a Cold War and you set it up in the way that he's doing right now by creating this infrastructure in Australia, you set the table for a crazy, and we know another crazy is going to get elected because of the way the Democratic Party operates, and we haven't had any real voting overhaul, and gerrymandering is going to continue. You set the table for someone like that to do exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think even under a Biden administration, we don't know what will happen, especially with, you know, aggressive military exercises that the Biden administration, like the Trump administration, have been running in East Asia. The potential for even an accidental clash with Chinese military forces is there on a near daily basis. And yeah, there's nothing about this that is hyperbolic. We should really be afraid, especially because we are, in my mind, reaching a point of no return on a Cold War with China. And I think folks should ask themselves, do we want a new Cold War? For those who lived through the first one and saw trillions of dollars wasted, squandered in a war that nearly brought us to global Armageddon through nuclear war, do we want that again for those who weren't alive during the Cold War? Do we want yet another endless war that's going to cost even more trillions of dollars, squandering it and stealing that money from the real human needs facing us, from building a green infrastructure that could save us from global warming, from protecting us against pandemics, from erasing global hunger and hunger in the United States, homelessness? That's what is at stake when we escalate military tensions with China and really solidify a Cold War that could be disastrous for the United States and disastrous for the globe.
Right, right. And I have a lot of fears about that as well. I did not live through the Cold War, but I have a lot of anxiety about the lack of understanding in the Biden administration and the Democratic Party as a whole about the colonial nature of our foreign policy. And there still is such rose-colored glasses about how we are a democracy and we are not like our oppressors in Britain when we actually declared independence. No, this is very, very similar, and we're living through it today.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I mean, that's another aspect of the alliance, the triple alliance with Australia and the UK, that hasn't been commented on enough. And this is colonial behavior. It's 19th century behavior in a bunch of ways, including the way in which alliance structures led us into World War I. But it's also colonial in, you know, these three white leaders, male leaders of Australia, the UK, and the United States standing up and saying, we're going to control what's going on in Asia. I mean, this is racist, this new alliance, this triple alliance, and should be profoundly troubling to all of us for that reason alone, let alone the danger of creating this new Cold War that could very easily become a hot, potentially nuclear war.
And again, last thing, that is why that anti-China bill that was passed in June, pet project of Chuck Schumer, had bipartisan support. That's why these people who were so concerned about Russiagate and it being a hoax and said, oh, it's going to start a new Cold War, are silent when it comes to the actual Cold War that's happening in front of us because, oh, well, there's Chinese people involved. I don't really care so much about us being in conflict with them.
which also shows how this policy is going to fuel anti-Chinese, anti-Asian, mm-hmm. anti-Asian American sentiment and racism that is already on the escalation.
Yeah, already absolutely. Escalating.
Excuse my...
No, of course.
Word salad.
Yeah, that's me on a daily basis. David Vine, professor of anthropology at American University and author of The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the United to the Islamic State. And you can read his brief at the Quincy Institute called Drawdown, Improving U.S. and Global Security Through Military-Based Closures Abroad. David, thank you so much for your time. I love the conversation today.
Emma, thank you. Really appreciate it.